Joseph considers these things. He was excited and dismayed by what he had overheard, and during this time it preoccupied his thoughts. For the exalted parents, he felt a lively disgust, only held in check by the need for politeness and reverence, not in the least by the darkness of ignorance. For neither his anger at the irresponsible stupidity of those old people in the sight of God, nor his abhorrence of their smug satisfaction at being secure against all reproach, was lacking in any element of clear-sightedness toward himself. It did not escape him that what he had heard possessed instructive implications for him, the descendant of Abram, and he would not have been Joseph had he not been ready to profit by them. The experience was calculated to broaden his view and warn him not to regard his own immediate spiritual home, the world of his fathers and its preoccupation with God, whose nursling and pupil he was, as something all too unique and incomparable. Not Jacob alone had cares in the world. Care was everywhere among men. Everywhere the anxiousness to be sure one understood this problem of the Lord and the times, though it might lead here and there to the most dubious expedients. And indeed, Jacob's inherited thoughts of God might afford the subtlest test one could apply to a possible decline of custom and tradition from the will and influence of the Lord. And anyhow, it was just here that error lay closest to hand. One did not even need to think of Laban, left clinging to the primitive, nor of the little son in the jar. There every kind of awareness of the problem had been lacking, even though the practice had already gone far to become an abomination. But precisely the developed sensitivity for such changes could easily lead one astray. Had not Jacob's painful misgivings in the matter of the feast tempted him to destroy feast and custom, root and branch, just because of their roots, which drew their nourishment from the unclean soil? The son had had to beg him to spare the feast, the tree that spread its shade and tossed its tip in the air, which, like the Lord, had risen out of the earth, but must wither if one uprooted it. Joseph was for sparing. He was not for uprooting. He saw in God, who after all had not always been what he was, a God of sparing and of passing over. Not even in the case of the deluge had he proceeded to extremes or hewed at the root of mankind, but had put the idea of the ark into the head of an exceeding wise man. Wisdom and passing over. These seemed to Joseph related thoughts, which might exchange their garb and even had a name in common. Goodness. God had tempted Abram to offer him his son, but then he had not taken him, introducing a ram in a most edifying way. The tradition of these people here, in however exalted kingdoms of taste they moved, was lacking in such good stories. There was some excuse for them, repulsive as they were with their sniggers over the blundering trick they had played on their children. To them, too, instruction had come from the Spirit of the Father in the shape of an uncertainly moving rumor, itself still very much having its being in the darkness, that one must emerge and escape from the stage of the traditionally sacred and come over into the light. They had received the instigation to the sacrifice. But how like Laban they were in their clinging to the old! For precisely to cling was what they hoped to do, by dint of making sacrifice to the new. But no ram had appeared to these God-forsaken ones that might turn into a ram of light. The sacrifice had been their trembling little son, Potiphar. Yes, one might truly call that a God-forsaken way of dealing, a gross lack of skill in going about to propitiate a new and splendid age. For an approach to the Spirit of the Father, thought Joseph, did not lie in taking things out by the roots, and there was truly a great difference between consummate double-sexedness and its utter abrogation in the courtier. For the double-sexed powers united both male and female glory in themselves, like the image of the Nile with one woman's breast and one man's, or like the moon that was wife to the sun and yet male to the earth, sending the ray of his seed to beget the bull on the cow. The relation of all this to the status of courtier was, in Joseph's mind, as two to nothing. Poor Potiphar! For a cipher he was, in all the splendor of his fiery chariot wheels and his greatness among the great of Egypt. His young slave Osarsif had a cipher for a master, a Reuben tower without the strength or the fallibility, a broken sacrifice, neither accepted nor rejected, a neither nor, not human nor divine, very proud and stately in the light of day, yet poor indeed, and in need of all the support and flattery that could accrue from outward circumstance, and especially from the devotion of Montcalm. Joseph considered that devotion afresh in the light of his new understanding, and did not hesitate to find it worth imitating. So it was. On the ground of the insight he had gained while playing the dumb waiter, he resolved to be helpful, as Montcalm was helpful, to his Egyptian master. Nor did he doubt that he would exceed the measure and quality of the other's service. For thus, he told himself, would he best be helpful to another master, and that the highest, in the task of prospering the young slave Osarsif in the land to which he had been transplanted. Here, in the interest of truth, we must warn the reader lest he level against Joseph the reproach of being coldly calculating. That would be precipitate and censorious. The situation was too complicated for such moral judgments, for Joseph had long been watching Montcalm, the oldest servant of the house, realizing that he was a good man, whose obvious flattery of his master deserved a better name, and must be called a service of love. And the conclusion followed that Potiphar, the honorary captain of the guard, must be worthy of such love, a conclusion confirmed by Joseph's own observation of his master. This great man of Egypt was a noble, fine, and sensitive soul, and kindly, too, in the slave's opinion. True, he took pride in making others tremble for his sake, but considering his status as a sacrifice to certain mistaken conceptions of the spiritual, that probably ought to be allowed him, Joseph thought. We see that it was not when Joseph began to serve Potiphar, but actually before it, and in his own heart, that he defended him and espoused his cause. In the first place, the Egyptian was his lord, to whom he had been sold, and highest of his sphere. And Joseph's conception of his relation to him included, by right of his tradition, an element of loyal forbearance, which was applicable not only in the higher but in the lower sphere, and to some extent to earthly conditions and immediate surroundings. We are to understand that the idea of the highest bore within it a conception of unity that was favorable to interchange and a certain equalization as between the higher and the lower. This was reinforced by the idea of helpfulness, the thought that he, Joseph, by serving Potiphar, as did Montcalm, would best be helpful to the wide designs of the highest who sent him his dreams. And other considerations as well came to make his relations with the highest to a certain extent color his attitude toward the master of the fiery wheels. He had seen Petipre's smile, melancholy, proud, and, yes, grateful in answer to the flatteries of Montcalm. He had seen the helpless loneliness it expressed. It sounds childish, but Joseph found a resemblance equally appealing to his pity between the solitary remoteness of God the Father and the isolation from the human lot of this tower of a man, this mutilated Reuben, however behung he was with the gold of favor. Yes, God, too, the Lord, was lonely in his greatness. And Joseph's blood and his memory spoke in the realization that the isolation of a wifeless and childless God had much to do with the jealousy of the bond he had made with man. Joseph knew the peculiar happiness which loyal service can give the lonely, the quite peculiar pain which lack of it can mean. He did not, of course, fail to see that God, after his nature, had nothing to do with procreation or death, for that he was both Baal and Baalat. The great difference between two and nothing did not for a moment escape him. Yet I but express in words what he certainly felt when I say that these intuitions of loving and sparing were dreamily at one in his heart when he resolved to keep faith with the cipher in its need, as he did with the needy too. Joseph speaks before Potiphar. And now we come to that decisive first meeting and conversation between Joseph and Potiphar in the orchard. It has not been described in any of the sources. None of the accounts, Oriental or Occidental, in prose or verse, so much as dream of it. It is in the same case as the countless other corroborative details which this version may boast of bringing to light and embodying in the accepted tradition. We know that it was again Besem-Heb, the mock vizier, to whom Joseph owed the long-desired and, in the result, decisive meeting, even though the dwarf could not actually arrange for it but only prepare the ground. And the preparation lay in bringing it to pass that the young slave Osarsif, heretofore lounging superfluous about, with but occasional occupation, was one fine day given a job as gardener in Potiphar's garden. Not, of course, as head gardener, for the head gardener was a certain Kun Anpu, son of Jedi, nicknamed Red Belly, because that part of his body was burnt by the heat and hung down like a setting sun over the apron round his middle. He was a man about the age of Montcaw, but lower in station, though possessing dignity and competence in his calling, well versed in the lore of plants, both for purposes of decoration and gain, and also on their medicinal side. Thus he was not only forester, gardener, and florist, but also apothecary and barber-surgeon, master of the arts of decoctions, drafts, salves, clysters, juices benign and malign, cataplasms, and emetics, which he prepared at need for man and beast. Though of men, it was only the servants for whom he prescribed, since the masters had a severe professional physician from the temple of the god. Kun Anpu's bald spot was red, too, for he scorned to cover it, and wore a lotus blossom behind his ear, as the scribes did their pens. Bunches of all sorts of herbs hung out of his apron, roots and shoots, which he snipped off or dug out as he moved among his plants. Shears, chisel, and a little saw hung from his waist and clanked as he went. He was stout, with a red face screwed up in an expression not at all unfriendly. His nose was knobby, his mouth likewise wried, whether in satisfaction or the opposite one could not tell, was covered with irregular unshaven hairs like little rootlets. They added to the earthy aspect of Red Belly's blinking, sunburnt face. His short forefinger, brownish-red and soil-encrusted, when he held it up to threaten some malingerer, looked like nothing so much as a freshly dug beet. Little Bess, then, had approached the gardener on the subject of the foreign slave. He had told him in a whisper that the stranger was gifted and skilled from childhood up in the knowledge of growing things, that before he was sold he used to tend his father's olives in the wretched Retenu, and out of love for the fruit had quarrelled with his fellows because they had thrown stones at the trees and crushed the olives too roughly in the press. Likewise had given the dwarf to understand that he had inherited a sort of charm, a lucky hand, as it were, of twofold nature, from heaven above and from the earth beneath, which was just what a gardener needed, and therefore Kun Anpu might take the boy among his underlings, as at present he was a loss to the household, being idle. It was dwarfish wisdom that spoke, and those who hearkened had never regretted it. Thus spoke the mock vizier, having in mind Joseph's desire to stand before the master, and knowing that employ in the garden would give him the best opportunity. For like all the great of Egypt, the fan-bearer loved his well-watered grounds, the like of which he hoped to possess and enjoy in the life after life. At various times of day he would rest there, or walk up and down, talking with the laborers if the mood took him, not only with Red Belly, their overseer, but with the workers as well, hoers and water-carriers. On this circumstance the dwarf rested his hopes, and they were well-founded. Thus Joseph was put to work by Red Belly, and it was in the orchard that he received employment, more precisely in the palm garden, which ran from south of the house to the edge of the pond, giving place to vineyards on the east near the court. But the palm garden was a vineyard too. Festoons of vine hung between the tall feathered columns, with merely openings here and there that one might pass through. The garlands were heavy with grapes, and the date palms bore each year a crop of many hundreds of liters. The sight of their combined fruitfulness was a paradisial delight to the eye. No wonder, then, that Petitpré loved his palm garden, with its basins of water sunk here and there in the ground, and often had a couch spread for him there, that he might listen at the same time to the breeze whispering in the crown of the palm trees, and the voice of the reader or the scribe making a report at his side. Here, then, it was that the son of Jacob found employ, of a kind both evocative and painful, since it called up memories of a dear and now frightfully lost possession, the veil, the coat of many colors, his and his mother's Cotonet Passim. Among its embroideries had been one he had noticed when for the first time he saw the shimmering bridal garment draped over his father's arms in Jacob's tent. It was a sacred tree, and on either side a bearded angel was fructifying it by touching it with the cone of the male flower. Joseph performed now the work of these two genii. The date palm is dioecious, and the task of pollinating the fruit-bearing trees with the pollen of those which produce pollen sacs instead of blossoms with pistil and stigma is performed by the wind. However, man long ago took over the job and practiced artificial pollination, cutting off the blossom of the non-fruit-bearing tree and bringing it into contact with the blossom of the fruitful ones. It was this which the genii of the veil had been doing to the sacred tree, and just this was Joseph now called on to perform. Redbelly, son of Jadee, head gardener to Potiphar, assigned him to the task. He did so by reason of Joseph's youth and the suppleness of his years, for it is a task not easy to perform. It takes agility in climbing, daring, and a steady head to do the office of the wind. With the help of a padded rope encircling his body and the trunk of the palm, the climber, with his wooden vessel or little basket, must work himself up the pollen-bearing tree, using what stumps and knots he can find for foothold, till he reached the crest, throwing up the rope each time from the height at which he had arrived with the motion of a driver who gives his horses the reins. Arrived at the top, he cuts off the panicles and puts them in his basket, then glides down the trunk. Then, one after another, he mounts the trunks of the fruit-bearing trees, and everywhere puts the seed-bearing panicles to ride, that is, to hang down inside the ovary-bearing flower stalk, which will then produce the pale yellow fruit. These can soon be picked and eaten, though the ones grown in the hot months, Paofi and Hather, are the really good ones. Kun Anpu, with his earth-encrusted beat of a finger, pointed out to Joseph the pollen-bearing trees, of which there were only a few, for a single one could pollinate some 30 of the fruit-bearing kind. He gave him the rope, which was very stout and of the best quality, made not of hemp, but of strands of reed, thoroughly soaked and beaten. He supervised the tying of it round Joseph and the first tree, for he was responsible should the master lose the price of the new slave by his falling and dashing out his bowels. He soon saw that the lad was clever. He scarcely needed to be tied, but swarmed up the trunk in a way to put a squirrel to shame, and reaching the top, performed the business with care and intelligence. Kun soon left him to himself, promising other work in the garden, and saying that he might in time become a proper gardener if he did well this work, and produced early and abundant fruiting of the pollinated trees. Not only was Joseph ambitious for the credit of his God, but also he found pleasure in the skilled and daring operation. He performed it with great zeal, bent on surprising Kun by his quickness and thoroughness. In general, indeed, this was the effect which Joseph sought to produce upon all men. He worked all day, and then another into the evening. At sunset, when beyond lotus pond, city, and river the sky unfolded the almost unbearable splendor of its daily crimson and tulip red, he was alone in the garden among his trees, or rather in them, setting the last of his panicles to ride by the swiftly failing light. He was sitting in the crown of a tall, swaying trunk, dealing with the fruit-bearing blossoms, when he heard whispering and footsteps beneath him, and glancing down, saw Beauty the dwarf, looking like a mushroom from that height. The mannequin waved with both arms and cupped his hands to his mouth.
"Osarsif!" he loudly whispered. "Osarsif! He is coming!"
Then he vanished. Joseph hastened to leave his employ and slid down the tree faster than he had climbed up. There, sure enough, Potiphar was approaching from the pond, between the festoons of vine, with a little train. An erect white figure in the sunset glow, with Montcaw beside him a step to the rear, Dudu, the guardian of the jewel house, and two scribes, rather farther behind, with Bess Emheb, who had stolen back to their side. Lo, Joseph thought, with his gaze upon his lord, there he walks in the garden in the cool of the eve. And when the group drew near, he flung himself at the foot of his tree, and laid his forehead to the ground, with his hands outstretched toward the master, palms up. Petipre stopped, and looked down at the arched backbone in his pathway. His train paused with him. "To your feet," he said briskly, but in a mild voice. Joseph, with one swift motion, obeyed. He stood close by the shaft of the palm, in humble posture, his hands crossed at his throat, his head bent. His heart was exceedingly ready and alert. It had come. He stood before Potiphar. Potiphar had stopped. He must not move on too soon. Everything depended on his staying. What question would he ask? One, it was to be hoped, which required an answer of some length. Joseph waited, his eyes cast down. "Are you of the household?" he heard the high, crisp tones inquire. For the moment, the opportunity afforded was small. Only by the manner and not the matter of the reply could he arrest the master's attention and persuade him not to move on. Joseph murmured, "The great master knows all. I am the least and lowest of his slaves. He counts him happy who is even the least and lowest of his lord."